Project construction update. You can see the slide up above you. Hardscape irrigation, electrical, and drainage basin work continues on the west side of El Camino between East Mall and Highway 41. So we are finished with the east side of El Camino as far as bulb outs, drainage, planters. And so if you want to see a look at the future, you can, I walked it again this afternoon. You can actually see all that, which is great. So delays to the east side of the street should not be any longer. There are new lane shifts and traffic delays, though, because we're working on the west side of the street. And I think motorists are still trying to get used to that this week. No parking areas will be marked, but businesses and driveways always remain open. So you, Huckleberry's is open, Mechanics Bank is open, Kochi is open, and the driveways will always remain open. So we appreciate people patronizing those businesses while work is being done in front of them. Do be mindful of bicyclists and pedestrians, especially with the changing traffic patterns. Slow down and stay alert. The good news is we are on schedule, and pending if we maintain dryness through into the holidays, we are trying to be off of the west side before the holiday shopping season starts. I know it's very important to our clothiers and restaurants and that sort of thing. So we're optimistic that we can get the west side done before we get too close to the holiday season. After that, we'll be working in the center of the street. So El Camino northbound and southbound will be in their respective lanes. There won't be lane shifts. We'll have K-Rail down the center and working on the medians and the parking. But then it'll be much easier that you can park parallel on the east and west sides of the street, and north and south traffic flow will be more normalized. So that's the goal, and then I think this is the hardest part of the project. So we appreciate the community's patience, and we continue to work with our business owners. The switching gears to several events. Now, we are an event city, and so I'm going to share with you a bunch of events, so be ready. Charles Paddock Zoo is offering two nights of Zoo Boo this year. This is always an important event that sells very well. We've heard from families in the past that one night may work or the other night may work, so there's no excuse. You have two dates that you can go to Zoo Boo. Maybe you can go to both and really get scared and get lots of candy. We'll have Halloween decorations throughout the zoo, carnival games, a costume contest for children and for the family, Halloween activities, a haunted maze, and we have a haunted barn if you want to be scared. So I understand it's not quite as scary as the haunt, but it is going to be pretty scary. We have live music and treats, and we want to see those costumes out there. So it's a total family-friendly thing to do this weekend. I'm looking forward to seeing everybody out there. If Zoo Boo and partying with the animals isn't your thing, maybe you want to do a trail ride at the Bovine Classic this Saturday, October 26th. It's a huge event. The race starts at 8:30. The festival begins at 12:30, and awards are at 4. This is deemed America's fourth hardest cow-themed gravel ride. So if you're interested, get in there because the entries could sell out. You need to sign up now. To remind you, I won't be in any of these races. There's a 93.6-mile race, a 69.3-mile race, a 49.6-mile race, and the baby bovine, 38.4 miles. So good luck to them. Okay, pray for a safe race. Our next update is World Lemur Day. Look at our lemur. We have several lemurs. We love them. World Lemur Day is this Friday with scheduled keeper talks talking about our prized lemurs that represent Madagascar. Visitors can enjoy learning about the mongoose lemur and the ringtail lemur during their part. These are free with the zoo general admission, these special talks, and getting to learn more about our lemurs. So World Lemur Day. Wow, that's a... Look forward to celebrating that. Our winter hours start at the zoo on November 1st from 10 to 4. So it will end, close a little earlier as we get into our winter hours. If you don't get enough candy at Zoo Boo, join me and everybody else on Entrada on Halloween from 5 to 8. We will have our trick-or-treat on Entrada between El Camino Real and Palma with plenty of vendors offering activities and candy. It is a sea of children and really fun costumes. We will have costume contests, children and pet categories, and prizes. So appreciate our business community pairing up with us on this. It'll be a great evening, and it is free. You will leave with lots of candy, and hopefully you spend a few dollars on our businesses. We appreciate them doing this, and we want to give them some patronage, too. First Friday, November 1st, so we have two nights of Halloween party at the zoo. Then we jump to Halloween, and we're still rolling. And the first Friday, Dia de los Muertos, is November 1st, 5:30 to 9. We have live music by Big Wheel Cobra at Historic City Hall. We have the Mariachi Mexicanismo Band strolling through downtown, the Folklorico dancers performing before the band begins. This was a great event last year, and I know it will be this year. We'll also have Art Hop going throughout the downtown. So Friday is going to be a great evening to be here. Other Halloween activities, if you aren't getting enough here, we have the Halloween Spooktacular. This is put on by one of our former city employees, Mark Russo. This thing, I think, has national attention now. I wouldn't be surprised to see it on the news. It's at 7720 Cortez Avenue. It's now through Halloween from 6:30 to 8:30. You can see some really great decorations. Mark pulls out everything. He loves the families in our community, and we're just proud to have a member of our city family doing this free thing for our community and sharing his passion. So thank you, Mark, every year. ABC Church is partnering with many other churches in the community, four other local churches, Sunday the 27th. Wow, the dentists are going to do a great business in November here. This is 4 to 6 in the Sutton Gardens. Candy games, food, more candy out of the trunks of lots of cars around the Sunken Garden. And our churches are putting this on. We thank them for a safe family event. That's Sunday from 4 to 6. More candy and games. And then the Haunt in Atascadero is known for being scary, and this year is no different. So the Haunt is open. They have a Lights On tour. That's probably what I could handle. They have regular tours and a terror tour. So $8 to $20, depending on the tour, at the Haunt. You should purchase your tickets in advance, thehauntinatascadero.com. Our partners at Visit SloCal have actually done a wonderful Halloween video featuring the Haunt, Poison Apple, several of our businesses to enjoy this fall and during the Halloween season. We appreciate that. Okay, today and the rest of this week is residential waste drop-off week. So we definitely have this great opportunity to drop off. You can fill a vehicle. This is not trailers, not toxic waste, not anything like that, but your old piles of wood and trash and different things that you couldn't recycle, please do take them to the dump. Get your voucher first from the Waste Management Office. This is for Waste Management customers. You can call 805-466-3636. It was a hit. I swung through there on my lunch hour today. There was about 10 cars out waiting, so I appreciate people taking advantage of that. My final update that I want to share is we've received our voter information guides, and so I want to hold that up. This is the voter information guide. This does have instructions on how to vote, but it also has the statements on positions of local measures. And so I want to make sure our voters cast informed votes. So as you go through past the directions, you can see statements for local races in here. And in the very back, in addition to the council election, we do have two local measures. And so I just wanted to touch on those to educate our voters. Our first local measure is L24. L24 is the continuation of our half-cent sales tax. This has been used for road maintenance in our neighborhoods. It is a half-cent. A yes vote would extend the tax. It maintains the tax rate at 8.75%, so it does not increase taxes. It maintains the tax rate. A no vote would reject the measure, and the tax rate would sunset a couple years from now. And that's about $3 million the city would then lose that we wouldn't have to invest in neighborhoods. So cast an informed vote on L24. It is on the back of your voter guide. The other measure is M24, and this is about appointing the city treasurer as opposed to electing it. The city treasurer is an elective office currently. It has been placed on the ballot by the council. A yes vote would allow for an appointive treasurer, the thought there being that an expert treasurer, like our administrative services director, Mr. Engel, could be appointed treasurer. It's an efficient move that saves the city about $17,000 a year. A no vote would mean that you want to maintain the office being elective. And so those are the two ways you can vote on M24. It's in the back of your voter guide. I just wanted to call out, I've heard some from voters that they didn't know this information was back here, so I just wanted to call that out to people to make an informed vote. Thank you, Mayor and Council.
Thank you for that, Mr. Lewis. Especially that appointive treasurer, we're not by law able to actually tell you what that means. So I've had messages from people saying, what is this? What does this mean? And you have to flip all the way to the back to get to it. So I'm very glad we pointed that out. Any questions on our city manager's report? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to community forum. This is the portion of our meeting that is reserved for anyone wishing to speak to the council on an item that is not on the agenda this evening, but over which the council has jurisdiction. Speakers are limited to 3 minutes, and we allot up to 30 minutes for community forum. We ask you to come forward and that you would state your name for the record to help us out. So welcome to our first speaker.
Good evening, council and members of staff. Public, Jeff Hosland, resident, still a business owner in Atascadero. I just may have switched businesses. I want to make a couple comments regarding L24, and I guess I'll add in on M24 as well. 20 years ago, our city was definitely not our best city that we could be. We had a lot of issues. At this day and age, we are fiscally responsible. We do things right. We have a great staff. Everybody works together. And I do encourage all of our residents in Atascadero to vote L24 yes, which I can say publicly. We've done a great job in resurfacing the neighborhood roads. We're making headway here in the city of Atascadero. As to our city manager, it does not raise our tax rate. It keeps it the same. We are a very different city than we were 20 years ago, and that's why I would vote for our treasurer to be an elected instead of appointed. We can trust everything going on in our city now. Sorry, I flopped it. And the other point is, unlike some of our other cities that have a large fiscal debt, we don't. And with the employees that we're hiring and keeping now, we're saving the city a lot of money because of what we have done. We don't have the turnover any longer, so we're not a training ground. Recruiting costs a lot of money. So again, I really do encourage anybody who can vote in the city of Atascadero legally to vote yes on those two measures. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oslin. Welcome to our next speaker.
Good evening, council members and staff. My name is Josh Cross. I'm the CEO of the Atascadero Chamber of Commerce. And I wanted to give you an update on the Shop Construction Bonus Program. Back in late July, we partnered with Sousa Construction, and they sponsored this program with a check for $10,000 with the idea that we'd use the full amount to purchase gift cards from businesses in the downtown area. And so the Chamber team has spent those funds supporting over 40, 45 businesses in the downtown area, buying like hundreds of gift cards, really. And we've been, and just to explain how the program works, for residents who spend $100 or more, they return their receipts to the Chamber of Commerce and get a $20 gift card to spend at another business in downtown, and up to two gift cards per household. And the program has been a big success. To date, we've collected over $65,000 in receipts from people spending in the downtown to collect those gift cards. So we're pleased with the success of the program. We're down to like three or four gift cards left. So we're about to see the funds expire. So we are looking under couch cushions and everywhere else to try and find some additional funding to keep this program going, ideally through the holidays. So that is something that the Chamber is working on. We'd love to partner with anyone who would like to help us out with that. But a big kudos to Sousa Construction for the work that they're doing and the timeliness that they're doing the work in, and to all the city team for helping us make this happen as well. So I just want to give you that update and let you know where we're at.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Any other members of the public wishing to speak for community forum? All right, seeing none, we'll go ahead and close community forum and thank both of the speakers for their comments. We don't have any public hearings this evening. We're going to move on to our management reports, and our first one is discussing a short-term rental ordinance framework, and I will turn this over to our community development director, Mr. Phil Dunsmore.
Thank you, Mayor and Council, and good evening. Been looking forward to talking about this since we had a discussion about this at our recent strategic planning session earlier this year. First of all, I'm going to give you just a few background tidbits on what these are. What are short-term rentals? What are vacation rentals? And I'm going to just take a quick breath for just a moment till we get the presentation up on the screen so I can show you what I'm talking about. Can you hear me okay, by the way, with this new system? New state-of-the-art audio? Wonderful. All right. First of all, I want to give you a little background. What are we talking about here? We're talking about any residential unit or even a room for that matter that's rented for less than 30 days. When they're rented more than that, that's a normal rental. That's a normal month-to-month rental. All of these types of rentals are also subject to what we call TOT or transient occupancy tax, just like a hotel or motel, like anything else in town. As of this year, as of September 2024. There's actually 139 of these that we're aware of in the city of Atascadero that are short-term rentals. We do tend to receive a lot of inquiries. We have seen quite an uptick in those in the last 2 years, and it's partly because of a lot of our surrounding communities have put in place limits and ordinances and caps on what can occur in their communities. Just as a number, too, in fiscal year 2024, the city did receive about $331,500 in transient occupancy tax just from these types of rentals alone. And typically, you know, when we look online at sites like VRBO, there's a scatter map of what we currently have in Atascadero, Airbnb, quite nice, actually, some of these units. So right, really a nice highlight of Atascadero shows these great properties. So this is what we're talking about. These are typically the main two sites you see these vacation rentals on. So earlier this year in strategic planning, we talked about a few topics, and you had asked our staff to bring some of this information back to you. We talked about, should we have limitations? Should there be a minimum separation? How should the existing ones be treated? Should they be grandfathered in? Should we distinctly have a difference between homestays and vacation rentals? And what are homestays? Homestays are when someone's renting a room inside an occupied primary residence when the people are still living there, rather than a vacation rental, which is renting out the entire house. And should we have an application process and fees for cost recovery? Right now, it's just a commercial business license over the counter. And should there be some flexibility for transferring property when they sell or when properties are handed down and when people go away? How should we handle these things? So what staff's done is we've looked at a number of features, not only what the state law prohibits, but what other communities are allowing right now. And state law does intervene quite a bit. They don't want to preclude affordable housing units, and especially they've limited us being able to put these in the newer accessory dwelling units, and that law came into place in 2020. They don't also allow them in what we call urban dwelling units, which is another new unit that the state allows through SB 9. And of course, they don't want them in deed-restricted affordable units. They want to preserve these units to preserve our affordable housing stock. However, as a local jurisdiction, we of course can create an ordinance to have additional regulations based on our local needs. So right now, we don't have anything in our municipal code that speaks to this. However, we do have a little bit of what I'll call local policy, because in the Community Development Department, we are able to adopt our own policies as to how we process these. And the building code also intervenes with that a little bit. So right now, we do issue a business license over the counter. It's called a home occupation business license. We only allow one of these per property. And in a commercial project, this is something that the building official determined some time ago, that only about 40% of the units in a commercial mixed-use project could be a short-term rental unless it actually converts to a hotel. And the reason for that is there's different building codes that regulate a hotel as compared to an apartment or mixed-use project. There's different exiting requirements and things like that. So some time ago, we put a 40% cap on those in the commercial zones. And of course, I mentioned, we don't allow them in the ADUs that are built after January 1, 2020, not allowed within a structure that's unpermitted, like a shed or a C-train in your backyard, hopefully. We don't currently have any limits in apartment buildings that are zoned residential. So there's a lot of avenue, a lot of areas where we could probably be doing a little better. What we did do is we looked at a number of other communities inside our county for the most part, and asked, what are you guys doing? What's happening? Our staff did a great job of doing some research there. And we are seeing quite commonly that the other communities just have an overall cap. They have a numerical cap. Paso Robles has that. Morro Bay's got that. Other communities have that. They also limit the number of people that can stay in a house at any one time, and it's based on the bedroom count typically. Some of them have distance limitations about how close they can be together, so there's not a thick cluster in a neighborhood that changes the neighborhood environments. They do require an application process, typically with a fee and an annual review of that, just to make sure they're continuing to meet their performance standards and bring in the annual transient occupancy tax. And a lot of these cities also have compliance through a third-party vendor. In other words, I hire a consultant that actually goes out and finds the rentals that aren't paying the TOT or aren't complying, and they bring them to your attention and say, hey, by the way, we found three or four out there that are renting their houses. You should be aware of that. And they also help with the TOT collection. So that's a pretty neat thing. And they actually really help with cost recovery. So cities are doing that. They also require that in order to be active, these units have to have a minimum number of annual stays and pay a minimum amount of annual TOT. And that's a good thing, actually, because in Tascadero, you saw that number that we have that we've offered business license to. It's like 139. But if you go look at all these sites, there's probably only, you know, a handful that are active, 20, maybe 30. And so a lot of people come into a municipality, they get their licensure, and so they just get their foot in the door so that they have something. But if we adopt regulations, we don't want that to be the case. We want them to be active so that, you know, if they're not going to be active, someone else can take that spot. If we had limitations, for example, we want to, you know, if we're going to go through the trouble, we want them to actually be active. Some communities also require that these folks give written notification to their surrounding neighbors to say, hey, I'm going to set up a vacation rental. Here's who you can contact if there's trouble. Here's what's going on. Here's what I'm doing. And then some communities require owner occupancy in the home shares. They require also, upon these things starting up, a building inspection, a fire inspection, to ensure that these units are actually safe, normal units that are safe for occupancy. And that's something that they get cost recovery for, and it's built into that annual application fee. So looking at all those things other communities do and looking at what we chatted about in our strategic planning, we came together with a few items just for us to discuss. And I think you could add a lot more, but you know, what might be effective for Atascadero? We might want to have some zoning standards, and I'll talk about those in great detail in just a minute. We might want to have an application that has cost recovery along with that building and safety inspection. It's probably a good idea to have a vendor that does the tax collection and monitoring for us. And in fact, we already have a vendor that works for the city, HDL, that can offer those services to us. And we're talking to them now about what they might be able to offer us. And we might want to consider those that are already having vacation rentals and how they might be impacted by a new set of regulations. And should we grandfather them in? And perhaps we should, as long as they remain active and continue to be part of that, what we call active, bringing in TOT and maintaining an active vacation rental. So I'm going to go through those four items. Here's the first one and some potential zoning standards. These are just examples. These are for our discussion, and we can come back to these and talk about them. But based on our research, we found these are some of the criteria that might work in Atascadero. So for example, what about distancing? What about spacing in between these vacation rentals? We have a lot of different neighborhoods in Atascadero. We have a lot of areas that are closer in that have smaller lots. And on those sites, it might be, you know, reasonable to say, okay, 500 feet. And that's about a distance of about 6 or 8 properties away. On the bigger properties that are over an acre, you've got to get to 1,000 feet before you have that distance separation. Some of those lots on the west side, you know, they're 200 and 300 feet wide or more, especially in the residential suburban zone. And so then you need to get a greater distance between each of those properties. And that's something that really just helps maintain that neighborhood compatibility and keeps a neighborhood and not a short-term rental neighborhood. We wouldn't really put in place distancing in multifamily zones. Instead, you could put in a cap in a multifamily project, and those are some of the things that we talked about, and we could throw that out there. And then in commercial, again, looking at if you have a mixed-use project, limiting it to 40% of the total units so that it doesn't become a hotel and doesn't require that occupancy change in terms of building code differences. And then in terms of number of folks per unit, the standard that we're seeing is about 2 guests per bedroom plus 2 additional guests per household. And then, of course, we can put in place standards to make sure that the parking's maintained on the property, that the noise limitations are those that we uphold in our municipal code, that the property's maintained. And then a big one, too, is can we say that you can only do this in your primary residence? And so that we don't get corporations buying multiple units, or that someone doesn't buy a house solely for the purpose of using it for an Airbnb and they never live there. That is certainly an opportunity that we could do. I will say that right now, I think the larger percentage of Airbnb vacation rentals that we have in the city are not likely that people's primary residence. They are a separate residence. They are an accessory dwelling, or they are something that, you know, someone owns four or five houses and they have those as one or two of them as vacation rentals. That's what I'm experiencing as I see that. So number two, what would an application look like? We would have to set up a specific process and a fee. We would like to see a building and fire safety review as part of that. We'd like to make sure that their unit can meet the performance standards that we just mentioned, the distancing, whatever other standards we might want to put in place, the primary unit standard. We might want to put in place a public noticing when that goes in. Not have it go to a hearing, per se, but at least to notify the neighbors around them, here's what's happening at their property. And then, along with that application process, an annual review. And making sure they're meeting those standards and having a minimum number of stays per year, a minimum amount of TOT, and then again, you know, options for those that might transfer or sell a house or, you know, be gone for a bit or inheriting and selling a property. Could those be transferred? Certainly. I talked a little bit about the vendor tax collection and monitoring. These seem like a really good idea. It actually is a revenue positive and really helps save staff time as well. And like I said, there's vendors already that we have working for the city that already have this type of service, and they can help track the unpermitted short-term rentals and assist us with compliance by letting us know and do those kinds of things. And then lastly, what could we do with the existing ones? That would be totally up to us. You could have them remain regardless of any new zoning policies as long as they maintain an active status and then demonstrate some rental activity in the previous 6 months, demonstrate a minimum amount of TOT remittance within the previous year. You can do things like that. So those are basically the nuts and bolts of what I wanted to introduce. We can talk about a lot of other options. We can come back, if you'd like, at your wishes, with a more refined ordinance. We can do that on its own, or we can even group it in with a comprehensive zoning update that we're doing right now as a follow-up when we get our general plan going next year. We're going to also, and we're already working with a consultant now for a comprehensive zoning update that's going to follow the general plan, and that's going to come through next year as well. But it's pretty easy to do this separately. What we would want to do is some outreach to the community. We haven't done that yet. We haven't let the community know that, hey, we're doing this, we're thinking about this, so I would advise that, and at least letting the existing folks know, and then maybe run this through the Planning Commission recommendation before coming back to City Council. So that's how a process would look. That's what we could do for next steps. At this point, I'd like to open up the discussion and answer your questions and see if the public would like to weigh in on any of these things as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. So I will look to my council. We'll start with Council Member Newsom.
It's so hard not to see you. I'm so used to talking directly to you. I know, there's a speaker in the way. We're not used to having it there. I guess we'd start back with what conversations we had at strategic planning. I want to make sure that we're abundantly fair to those existing short-term rental and vacation rentals. And one of the things that we discussed at the strategic planning was maybe to reach out to them to get feedback and have them weigh in on some of this policy that we're trying to establish. In strategic planning, I admitted I have an Airbnb, not in this city. quite a ways away from here, so I'm a little bit versed on the operations of how that works with Airbnb, VRBO, as well as long-term residents. I think it's needed to have it, but what I'm worried about is how many people were contacted out of 139 on that list to participate tonight in feedback.
We haven't done outreach yet. We wanted to have this discussion, and then we could do another session and then do outreach to all those folks. So that has not happened yet.
My concern is having a conversation without even understanding how it affects our community before we even sit here and go through these items of what council should be putting in place for someone else's property rights.
Mayor Pro Tem Funk.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions, and then I have some thoughts that we'll share later. First of all, you mentioned that there were 139 current folks that have licenses, or that are the business licenses for short-term rentals. I feel like my sound's cutting in and out here.
You sound great.
Okay, good enough. Do you know how many of those are those current residents of the community who have licenses for properties in the community, and how many of those are from elsewhere?
I don't have those statistics for you this evening, but I can guarantee they're not all from a residence of the city of Atascadero.
So we've got some mixture of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. And on the multifamily units where these, as you looked at how this works in other jurisdictions, to what extent are other jurisdictions placing restrictions on the multifamily units in order to preserve their multifamily housing stock for permanent residents? And to what extent, if they don't, do people actually try to run Airbnbs out of in apartment buildings and apartment complexes?
Where we're seeing that is in areas that are very heavily tourist-driven. Morro Bay is a good example, where if they didn't have strong limits, they would have much higher numbers in their multifamily and apartment projects. I don't know that that would be the drive here. I think the more of the desire here is to have more of that country, wine country, quiet, you know, location kind of setting. That's kind of our thing in the North County. So we don't see a whole lot in Atascadero that are in apartment complexes. We tend to see them on a single family properties, but other communities do have limitations. They have strong caps and they have strong distance limitations. And those are the things that have to go into place in those heavy tourist communities to make sure they maintain their housing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And to what that this may be maybe not a question directly for you, but for might be Director Banish out there. But to what extent, if you have Atascadero had the experience that we see in parts of Paso Robles, where there are entire streets that are essentially non-residential. They're become Airbnb in house after house after house, because they didn't put these any restrictions in place before all of that had happened. To what extent does that interfere with our goal to be an authentic community as we market ourselves to others and create a resident-serving experience that is something that others from outside of the community might want to enjoy?
It's difficult to actually really quantify that and answer that question directly, but obviously it does change the feeling and spirit of neighborhoods when you've got a high density of vacation rentals. We don't anticipate that would really happen in Atascadero, except in a downtown situation where people want to stay in that kind of a situation, because we just don't have that kind of a tourism drive in Atascadero, but it possibly could
yes.
happen, and it certainly does change the character, and it takes away from a certain kind of local feel. It certainly does, and that's perspective. That's based on opinion. It's not something that you can quantify perfectly. And in fact, I think one of the things that I didn't mention in the presentation that was a question of from council early on is, are we receiving a lot of complaints from these units? We're really not. We receive a couple. I spoke to code enforcement today. I spoke to my planning team today. You know, we've looked at this, and I can't say that we have a large number of singled out vacation rentals that are creating significant issues. There's a couple. Certainly there's a couple. But there's a lot of other complaints from residential neighborhoods too, where people are fighting with each other. So this doesn't stand out as a category that is substantial.
Okay. Yeah, I think we're all familiar with a couple of, at least one code enforcement situation that have been of some longstanding. Because these situations can be difficult. And so thank you for anticipating my next question about the frequency of that. Do we have any breakdown to that end of the 139 units between how many are home, roughly, how many are homestay type units where the owner is still living in the building, where, you know, if the party gets out of control, the person you're going to wake is the owner. That's, you know, that is self-limiting in its risks to the rest of the community versus the, you know, whole unit vacation rentals where the owner is probably elsewhere.
Do you recall if we separated that out, Alexandria? I don't recall if we went to that extent. Sorry to call it. Surprise. Maybe she's going to come all the way up and speak. I didn't mean to do that. Alexandria is our senior planner, and she did a lot of research on this to pull this together. But I don't recall we had those statistics. But anyway, Alexandria Fowler.
Hi. Thank you, Alexandria Fowler. So the way that we permit right now through the business license, it doesn't have a delineation how people are using it. So if it's whether or not a vacation rental or a home share. So we don't collect that data at this point.
Okay. Thank you. Something we might want to continue that. We might want to adjust that just to give, while we have this under consideration, to be able to gather that data, in at least for future requests. That might be very helpful. Okay, thank you.
Councilmember.
Yeah, I have several questions. Along those lines, I know HDL, you mentioned HDL gathering some of the data on this regarding the TOT collected. If we were to pursue an ordinance, there's other firms that kind of do more of the enforcement type, you know, identify non-compliant properties, that sort of thing. Because I assume one of the ways to identify what Mayor Pro Tem Funk was asking about is you know, just going on those sites, Airbnb, RBO, and see if they're being advertised as whole house or guest house or, you know, spare bedroom, you know, because that would, you know, obviously if you're staying in a guest room, you don't have the whole house. If you're staying in an ADU, you don't have the main house. But are they being advertised? And we don't have any idea of that, Ryan. Is what you're saying?
We don't at this time, other than, yeah, we could do that.
Okay.
You know, random research.
In terms of self-limits on this, I assume that certain neighborhoods that have HOAs probably have rules about this that don't allow, like, let's say, the Lakes or Dove Creek or Apple Colony, some of the newer larger subdivisions. I assume they may have their own rules that preclude or limit this short-term rentals?
They can if they wish, and some do, yes.
Okay, got it. Also, in terms of apartments, you know, we have the limits you mentioned in the report, but if let's say I, you know, occupy a two-bedroom apartment, I could rent out one of those unless my landlord prohibits it?
Yes, unless it's within your rental policies that you can't, certainly.
Got it. And then you mentioned right now somebody, all they got to do is pull a commercial business license, and you mentioned it being under the category of home occupancy permit, which if they don't occupy the home, it's, I guess, maybe not technically a home occupancy, but that's how it's categorized right now?
It is if it's in a residential district. The only way we can issue a business license, a commercial business license to someone who has a residence or in a residential district is through the home occupation permit process. So that's how we do that. Now, if they were in a commercial district in a residential unit that's in a mixed-use project, it might be different. But now if they have a commercial business, like they're a rental agency, and they decide to do a vacation rental, they might pull a business through their rental agency, but the location of their rental is residential, and it may not come through as a home occupation. It might be a commercial business license. So it all depends on the parameters of where it's based and where who's paying the bill.
Okay. There's nothing in the phraseology governing home occupancy permits to say you should occupy the home.
No. A home occupation business license is simply issuing a commercial type of business license or a business license to someone who operates a business out of their home, whether they're selling something from their home, whether they're providing a service, or whether they're doing something like a vacation rental.
Right, but I mean, in general, if I'm running a home occupying business, whether if I'm an architect or I'm a travel agent or whatever, I might do that. I mean, if I do it from my home, there's nothing in the wording that implies that it's my home, that I live there.
No, it just implies that you're doing it out of a home.
A home, okay. Not my home, so to speak. Okay. Okay, in terms of the numbers, because one of the things, you know, is looking at how other cities went through this process, and they went through great machinations. I guess I understand it theoretically, what the idea behind limiting numbers or distances, but if this only was allowed in homeowner occupied situations, that really wouldn't be a factor then, would it? In other words, if I rent out my ADU and Mark rents out his ADU next door and Heather rents out her ADU next door, that's not the same impact as three houses in a row that are unoccupied except for short-term rentals?
Correct. It's still a minor impact, but not as significant if it was the whole household and someone's over there having a big party, a retirement celebration, a wedding, you know.
Right.
So.
Okay. Got it. I have a lot of comments, and I may have some further questions.
Councilmember, I think to really be clear, I think there is a difference for two main reasons. One, you maintain a housing unit because a person's still living in it as their primary residence. And I think one of the, thank you. I'm sorry, Mayor Pro Tem. I think there are kind of two key differences to be a little clearer to the point. You do maintain a housing unit if you have a policy that your primary residence must be what's rented because it's where someone actually lives. So, and then the second, one of the fears is leaving trash cans out or a lack of community or lack of respect for neighbors that you might have in owner, investor-owned units. Whereas if it's your primary home, you live with your neighbors for majority of the year, you have to make sure that you're renting it responsibly. So communities have turned to that as a way to maintain housing stock and ensure quality of renters and communities.
Okay, thank you. In terms of like an initial inspection, so let's say somebody, we have an ordinance and somebody applies to have a short-term rental, and we send out a code enforcement person to do an initial inspection, and it turns out the person is advertising a, you know, converted garage as the unit in question, and it's an illegally converted garage. That would be the kind of thing we would address as part of the inspection program, I assume.
Yes, and sometimes we can even look at that without an inspection process because we look up the records that we have in-house to determine what structure is. So some of that can be done without going out. But in the end, it's always best to go and take a look at the situation.
And right now, if somebody gets a commercial business license for doing this, just as if they did a home occupancy for something, do they renew that license annually as part of just as a commercial business license? Or is that a one-time get the license?
They do need to review it annually, or renew it annually, pay an annual fee.
Okay. And okay, I'll have other comments and maybe questions after public comment. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Councilmember Darris.
Thank you. Yeah, I've got several questions myself. As we know, Airbnbs have gotten really popular over the years. A lot of times it's the most economical way to stay in a place. And I think as time goes, you know, like I said, Paso Robles has a cap on the number. And once that cap is reached, if they haven't already reached that, then I think Atascadero is going to be the next choice. And then we're going to get to that point where So it's going to get, it could potentially become a problem. As I was reading through this, I'm looking at this from both sides, I can see that this is one of those unique things where the city will benefit from this, obviously from the TOT tax, and some of the residents will benefit from it because they're making money themselves. But there's also some other unintended consequences, I think, that may happen. And I'll try to get to some of those if I can and clarify that. One of the questions that I have, and this isn't, has anything to do with unintended consequences, but and was kind of touched on a second ago here. You mentioned that ADUs that were built after 2020 cannot be used as a short-term rental. Okay, that's pretty clear. If somebody built an ADU after 2020, can the owner live in that ADU and then use the house as a short-term rental?
Yes, that's a creative solution. They can.
Okay, they can. The next question I have is on parking. So there's houses, because it was stated in there that parking needs to be provided, which makes sense. But if you have a single-family house, regardless of the number of bedrooms, you're required to be able to park two cars. And sometimes it has to have driveway, and not just in the – you have to have adequate parking. And usually that adequate parking accounts for two cars. But if you have a house that's being used as a short-term rental that is, say, five bedrooms, you could potentially have, say, a family reunion and five couples that are renting cars, and now you've got five cars. So how is it going to be regulated that that the person operating the short-term rental needs to, how can it be regulated to say, look, you can only have two cars, no matter how many couples or people that's going to be staying there? I mean, that's a concern that I have, because I can see that happening where they're renting it with five couples and three of those cars are parked on the street.
That may be difficult to regulate, and it's certainly a possibility. Typically on these larger homes, they have much larger properties with big driveways and big areas, and it doesn't become an issue. I think in our regulations, we would require that all of their parking be maintained within their property. And I think that's where we would draw that line, because otherwise it does get very challenging to say, hey, your parking has to be within your garage or your regulated parking spaces, because there's so many different unique situations.
Okay. On the minimum number of stays, in the report it said that we would mandate that if you're going to have a short-term rental license, then you have to show that you have 10 stays a year. You're renting it for 10 different stays a year. Is that correct?
And that's just an example number.
Okay. So where I was, again, I'm trying to look at this from both sides. So from the city side, I'm like, that's great. We can get 10 stays. That means we get TOT tax from 10 different times. If I'm a homeowner, and one of the things we talked about when this came up in March or whenever it was, I look at certain homeowners, maybe myself, maybe not, and I go, well, I don't want my neighbors to rent, to know that they're moving out and they're going to rent their house as a short-term rental, and I got to deal with parties every other weekend or something. So we have this distance thing, so okay, well, I'm going to get a license, and I know this is addressed in it too. I'm going to get a license, and that prevents anybody from else doing it. However, in order to do so, I have to now show that I'm having 10 stays. Okay, so if I then at the end of the year, or however it's going to be collected, say, well, I had 10 stays. They were one day at a time, one day stays each time. So I will pay the TOT tax on a one day stay throughout the year. I'll consider that a tax to guarantee that my neighbors don't do it. So the question is, can we, if we're going to do this 10 stays, should there be a minimum number of days per stay? That benefits the city from saying, we know we're going to collect a minimum amount of TOT tax, and it's not just going to be one day. And it also maybe protects the neighbors or protects the person that wants to use their place as a short-term rental.
We can design this however you like. Well, you bring up some good points. But I don't know if anyone would go to that extent just to keep another person out, but it's a possibility.
I don't know.
And it certainly can. You never know.
I'm sure they would.
So
it
we
sounds
can do
like Council Member Darris might.
it just might.
But and these are the things that we have to think about if we design these parameters. You know, what is the minimum amount of TOT? Should it be a minimum number of days a year instead of stays a year? These are different ways we can look at it.
Yeah, and I think that's important, because I think there's Again, it protects the person, you know, maybe the person, the legitimate person that wants to do it responsibly versus a person that just wants to make sure their neighbors aren't doing it. So I think there's needs to be a balance there. And again, if I wanted to guarantee that none of my neighbors are going to do it, I'd happily pay a 1 day, you know, 10 days versus TOT just to make sure they're not going to happen, if that was my goal. And on that note, multifamily was brought up. In the report, it said that that's a scenario where there isn't a distance separation. So again, if whether it's the owner of the apartment complex or maybe an individual that says, well, I'm going to rent 15 or 20 apartments and I'm going to use those as short-term rentals, and if they're clustered more or less together or several of them are clustered, and there's one poor family that's living amongst these short-term rentals, that's going to ruin their experience in their living conditions. And so I think something like, so maybe there needs to be a separation in apartment complexes to some degree, somehow. I don't know how that's going to be formulated, but I see that as potentially being a problem, because whether it's the owner of the complex or somebody coming along and saying, I'm going to, you know, rent a block one way or another, and I, you know, again, protecting the people that live there that want to have a peaceful quality of life, this could have an effect on that. Okay. Anyway, I guess I didn't have as many questions as I thought I had, but those are the big ones that I wanted to hit now. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to have a real strong understanding of primary residence and in all the different variations, because one thing I understand that a homestay is somebody renting a room in a primary residence. So that's subject to TOT, but what we're saying is that we would not most likely make them subject to whatever, you know, ordinance we're coming up with. That's a possibility.
With a homestay?
With a homestay.
Correct.
But that's still subject to TOT.
Correct.
Okay. So that's one use of homestay. What are other uses of primary residence when it comes to talking about short-term rentals beyond just renting a room?
Well, someone could still have a primary residence and they could go away for a month and they could rent their house out while they're on vacation, and that's originally okay. How Airbnb started, so that can still work. It's not as common.
You could also originally home how swap. All these things.
Yeah.
You can home swap. So I'm going on vacation in a place where you live, and then we switch homes for 2 weeks, and, you know, that's another option, I guess, that you could use your primary residence for.
Okay. And then would there be some type of limit on, like, how would we know for sure that was somebody's primary residence, that they didn't just say, oh, yes, this is my primary residence, but I'm assuming it would be maybe number of days rented that whatever company we hired would be monitoring, or how would we know that this didn't simply become a investor-owned rental?
Well, I mean, through the tax assessor, we know what their primary residence is and what their other residences are, so they would have to just demonstrate that that's their primary residence, if that's the way the council wanted to go.
So, and I agree with the director, but I have a little experience with this in my former life, as you all know. There's a few things. So when you apply for your license, you would demonstrate, you'd show that you declare the homeowner's exemption, which if that's not your home, that's a crime. Two, you would show voter registration, and your tax returns. Those were things we required, if you wanted to be that firm on what your primary residence was. Then every year, the enforcement software can look at how many days your residence was rented. And in some cases, perhaps, depending on how the ordinance is listed, how many times you tried to rent it. Because you shouldn't try and rent it more than 6 months in a day, right? Otherwise, it's not your primary residence.
5 months and 29
days. Or 5 months, exactly, Mayor. And so, yeah, and so there's software that we can actually check that. And to do so is a violation and a penalty, and you can lose your permit or count that as a, you know, warning. But that's how we did it. And as a matter of fact, we did catch a few people. It's interesting, too, neighbors can be very neighborly if you're renting your house too much and turning it, and they're very